various visitors, I want to echo Mike's prayer that we encourage you. Take a few moments, just give us a chance to catch up with you, to meet you, and to enjoy your presence here in this assembly. I appreciate the announcement being made. We're very, very excited about baby number four. Unfortunately, Rachel and the kids are not here. We had a confirmed case of the virus about 5 minutes away from where we were at in Valrico, Florida, right, and actually very close to the same apartment we used to live in. And so we were trying to be cautious about that. So I said it earlier, but I want to echo it in case you did not hear it. If I do not shake your hand, please do not take that as me trying to be offensive or anything. We're just trying to be very cautious about we don't know what we don't know. I'm just trying to be a little bit careful about that. And really the concern is not I don't want to touch you icky people. I do not want to get anybody sick. And so I'm just trying to be cautious about that. And so one of the things that we talked a little bit about earlier, and I want to reiterate it, we have such an opportunity as Christians to shine light in this time. In the early days of this, obviously the virus first broke out in the Wuhan province of China. And before the Chinese government had gotten everything under control, while the Chinese government was still in panic, the people that were going to deliver food and to deliver medicine, do whatever they could, was the Christians in China. That in the face of a unknown plague, in the face of something that could have very easily infected them, they were all on the front lines serving their people and doing good for their community. And certainly we've heard reports of what goes on in Italy. There's a large number of Christians in North Italy that are suffering at this time, and they're doing the same thing. They're doing whatever they can to praise God in a dark time. And I think we as Christians in a land that right now is very blessed to not have a whole lot of this virus, we have an opportunity to glorify God in a lot of ways. We can be praying for our government in a time where a lot of people are mocking and a lot of people are bad-mouthing. We can be praying for our government. We can speak well of our leaders. We can show grace and encouragement to those who are anxious over this, to those who may have loved ones who are immunocompromised and elderly. We can show grace and comfort to those people. And we can show courage and trust in the Lord in a time where a lot of people are worried. We can show that there is a better way than what the world would have. And I would encourage all of you, whatever the situation may end up being in the next few weeks, that we remember, as was said so well by Brother Tim, that we are here to worship God and that we are here to live for God. And that even as we leave these walls, our spirit does not change. Our faith and our trust in the Lord does not change. And I encourage all of us to continue thinking on these things, continue to place our trust in the Lord. We got the opportunity in the first lesson to speak about the downfall of King Saul. And it is a terrible and tragic story, as was mentioned in the prayer, of what happens when sin is left unchecked. But as tragic and as terrible as the downfall of Saul is, there is a light in that darkness, and that is that it is now time for the king to ascend. This David, who we have seen as a faithful warrior of God, we have seen as a righteous individual, he is the king that it appears as if Saul was incapable of being. And now at the beginning of 2 Samuel, we see King David arising to power. And I think the way that David comes to power, and the first things we see in 2 Samuel, is a fascinating insight into the character of King David. And in particularly, I'm not sure there is another passage, with the notable exception of Christ on the cross, a better example of the command we have been given to love our enemies. Remember what has been going on in the book of 1 Samuel? King David has been chased all over Israel by King Saul. So much so has he been harried and threatened with death that he has had to flee to the Philistines, to the enemies of God's people. Those are the only people that he has been able to find that have been trustworthy, unlike King Saul. It is a dire indictment on King Saul and his failure that King David has to flee to his enemies. And yet now, David gets to become king. Now is the moment that David has been waiting for. Now is the moment where David sees his promises being fulfilled, and he finally hears word that his enemy, the man who multiple times has tried to kill him, who though David has spared him, Saul sought his death, who though David tried to serve, Saul sought to destroy, David finally hears that Saul has died. And listen to how David responds. It says in verse 11 of chapter 1 that David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so also did all the men who were with him. They mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel. because they had fallen by the sword. David said to the young man, and this young man had been the one to deliver the news of King Saul's death. In fact, this young man had taken credit for ending Saul's life as he lay wounded on the road. David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." Then David said to him, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said, "Go, cut him down." So he struck him and he died. David said to him, "Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" David is concerned about justice. He is concerned that a man who had been anointed by God, and notice that that's what David focuses on. Not the man who opposed my kingship, not the man who sought to kill me, not the man who divided me from my wife and broke me away from my best friend, who forced me to flee and be a madman in the desert. The Lord's anointed has been slain, and there is going to be justice done for that. It shows his enormous respect, one for Saul, but his enormous respect for the Lord. The Lord may have decreed that Saul was no longer the chosen king, but that's not man's job to inflict what the Lord has done. The Lord's hand was clearly at work, but it was not for this Amalekite to decide for himself what to do. And then we see David chant one of the most heartbreaking laments in the entire Old Testament. It says, David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. "Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How have the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice, the daughters of the uncircumcised will exult. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor fields of offerings, for where the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished?" You talk about loving your enemies. Of a king who has finally been given what was rightfully his, finally given what was promised of him by the Lord, and his concern is one that his friend has died, but that his enemy has died. That Saul, the anointed king of Israel, has been slain by God's enemies. And he mourns for his brethren. What a beautiful example of a Christian heart. And I know David's not a Christian, but what a beautiful example of God's heart. He does not glory in the death of his enemy. He does not glory in, "Man, finally, I get what's rightfully mine." He is heartbroken that this is what it took. He is heartbroken at the cost of sin. That should be our attitude towards our enemies. This is a clear example of how our mindset should be towards even those who viciously oppose us. What a tragedy that they have to die. What a tragedy when they fall. What a horrible thing it is for man to die. That's a tough thing. Can you imagine praying this and put this in our modern situation? Can you imagine praying this over the soldiers of ISIS? Can you imagine lamenting the death of Chinese soldiers? Can you imagine mourning the death of Vladimir Putin? That's what this is. That's what David is doing. He is not just saying, "Oh yeah, you know, it's a shame they're dead." He rends his clothes. He is heartbroken that this has occurred. This is the level of compassion that God's own heart delivers. And I think it should be a clear example to us of the kind of love that we should have for all people, even those who oppose us. And this does not end in the first chapter. Indeed, David is then made king over part of Israel. He's made king over Judah, but the rest of Israel sides with the last remaining son of Saul, Ish-bosheth. And a civil war occurs. And fighting has to occur between David's men and Ish-bosheth's men, and the civil war is long, it is bloody. And you would think that David would be frustrated by this. But when David's two chief enemies, the general Abner and the king Ishbosheth, are killed, he reacts the exact same way. When Abner is murdered by David's nephew Joab, his own general, it says in chapter 3 and verse 33 that the king chanted a lament for Abner and said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies, your hands would not bound nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." Abner was one of Saul's generals. He was part of the force that tried to kill David in the previous civil war, and now he sided with Ishbosheth. And yet he mourns this man. And then when Ishbosheth is murdered by some of his own people, he treats them just like the men who murdered Saul. And those men are put to death and given justice. What an incredible king. What an incredible man after God's own heart. That this is the love that he would have for his enemies. And finally, we are seeing this is what it means to be a king for God. This is what it means to be a leader who looks not to his own advancement, but a leader who seeks to do the will of God. This is the kind of character that we should have when we deal with those who oppose us. Do you think David probably prayed for Saul? Do you think he worried about Abner and Ishbosheth and these men? This is not the action of a man who has hated these men all this time and then at the last moment says, "Well, you know, I've got to make sure I love my enemies, so let me say some good words about them." This is the outpouring of a heart who has been concerned about these men. This is the outpouring of a man who served his king Saul faithfully and wanted what was best for him, even when Saul did not feel the same towards David. This is the kind of heart we should have towards our enemies, and it shows us the importance of having a heart after God's own character. And so as Ishbosheth and the rest of Saul's house comes crashing down, David begins to ascend, and David becomes king now over all Israel. And we see in the next few chapters, almost like a second conquest. Did you see in these chapters as we read about David's military victories, about who he's actually fighting against? Certainly he initially fights the Philistines, and we really don't see the Philistines rise again for several hundred years. David defeats the Philistines like Saul was supposed to, but did you see that he also fights against the Amalekites? The same group of people that Saul had been commanded to destroy? Apparently it was not just Agag that he had left alive. David not only completes the task that Saul had failed to carry out in defeating the Philistines and the Amalekites, but then we see him fighting some of the same peoples that the judges of Israel had fought against. He fights against the Moabites, against the Ammonites. He fights against all these people that have oppressed Israel. And we now see several hundred years later, David fulfilling the terms of the conquest. That work that was started all the way back in Joshua. We see that David is completing what was supposed to have occurred. We see David conquer the city of the Jebusites, one of the seven groups of people who were ordered by God to be destroyed. It is David who finally destroys their capital city, and he renames it Zion, the city of Jerusalem, the city of God. And so we see that David, even in the midst of these incredible victories, victories that no Israelite, not even Joshua, had fully completed, who does David give credit to? He gives credit to God. When we read of the Psalms, and we're going to take some time later in the year to discuss the Psalms, we'll talk about some of the Psalms of David as he praises God over all of these things. But we see that David recognizes that it is God who is his victor. If you would, turn just briefly over to Psalm 61. There are a number of different Psalms that we could speak of, a number of different Psalms of David that talk about the protection of God. But listen to this Psalm that David gives. Remember, this mighty warrior who has slain Goliath, who has led Israel to victory, who any other king with the accomplishments of David, you would have monuments to him still to this day in Israel. And yet here is where David's heart is. In Psalm 61, "Hear my cry, O God. Give heed to my prayer. From the end of the earth I call to you when my heart is faint. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I. For you have been a refuge for me, a tower of strength against the enemy. Let me dwell in your tent forever. Let me take refuge in the shelter of your wings. For you have heard my vows, O God. You have given me the inheritance of those who fear your name. You will prolong the king's life. His years will be as many generations. He will abide before God forever. Appoint loving kindness and truth that they may preserve him. So I will sing praises to your name forever, that I may pay my vows day by day. This is a king who has accomplished far more than almost anyone else in the Bible to this point in terms of military conquest. And yet his prayer is that God would be the one who sustains him. We got a chance to talk in the adult Bible class about how grace lifts us up, about how grace is not recognizing our own strength, but recognizing the strength of God. And David understood grace. David understood that all of these victories, all of these triumphs that he had had was because of God's power and not his own. David, with exception, seems to have rarely forgotten that he was a shepherd boy who had not earned this throne by right of his father, who had not been given this throne because that was what was always supposed to happen. He had been given this throne solely by the power of God. That he had fled before Saul, that he had been rejected by half of Israel, and that the reason he was where he was because of the power of God. And he never wanted to leave that power. He never wanted to be separated from the great protection of the Lord. And it's interesting, we'll talk about this a little bit more next week, but it's interesting that the very conclusion of this book of Samuel highlights some of David's weakest moments. And indeed, the book of Samuel does not flinch away from showing the failures of David, from showing David when he's weak, because the point of the book is that God is king. David is an incredible character study. He is an incredible person to look at as an example, but he's pointing the way to God. He's showing that his majesty, his power, his greatness is nothing compared to what God is accomplishing. And that's really, as we have said in every book to this date, and we'll probably say it for every book to this point, the hero of this story is God. He is the one who is leading Israel to these great victories. And indeed, we then see, in one of the most important chapters we have read to this point, we get to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now, as we've been following along the Bible story, we've been noting several important prophecies, several important promises that have been made. Because we have a tendency sometimes, because we have the whole Bible, we tend to kind of read back into certain things. We're like, oh, that's how X, Y, and Z comes together. But remember, there's been a progressive revelation through this time period, that the promises made to Abraham were expanded in the promises made to Isaac, expanded in the promises made to Jacob, expanded in the promises made to the nation of Israel. And now we have the promise of God extended one more step in one of the most important passages in the Bible. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, as David is reflecting on the great successes that he has been given, as he is dwelling in the city of Zion, he goes and he wants to build a house for the Lord. Remember, at this point, the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle. It was still in this mobile tent. Even though Israel had a kingdom, even though Israel was settled in one place, the Ark of the Covenant was still in, essentially, a mobile home. And so David says, why shouldn't the Lord have a permanent dwelling place? I want my city of Zion to not just be the home of the king. I want this to be the home of the Lord. He wants to build a temple for God. And the response is truly amazing. Turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 7. And in verse 4, it says that in the same night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, go and say to my servant David, thus says the Lord, are you the one who should build me a house to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent, even in a tabernacle. Whenever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, did I speak a word with one of the tribes of Israel, which I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep to be ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, have cut off all your enemies from before you, and I will make you a great name like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed anymore, nor will the wicked afflict them anymore as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all of your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Now we're starting to see some of these threads from around the Bible are starting to come together. In Genesis chapter 3, remember that very first prophecy that we had been given was the idea of this seed of Eve, the seed of woman, was going to come, was going to defeat the seed of Satan. And we've been waiting for that seed. We've been waiting for that man, that descendant, who was going to come and defeat the serpent of evil. And then we were shown that this blessing was going to be fulfilled through Abraham. But not only was the serpent going to be defeated, not only was Abraham going to be blessed, but his nation would be blessed and all nations would be blessed through him. And we see these promises reflected to Israel, that they will come to the Holy Land, they will become a blessing to all peoples. And now we see that the way they're going to do that is going to be through a king. Not a king like Israel has longed for, not a king that will lead them to great military conquest, but a king after God's own heart, a king of David's lineage, a king that will follow the will of the Lord. David wants to build a house for God, and God says, no, I'm going to build you a house, a dynasty, a long-lasting kingdom that will never fall. Now, remember, in the context of the story that we're reading, we're thinking, okay, so the kingdom of Israel is going to exist forever. Now, that's about to come into some question, because as we know, in four chapters, all of this great promise and all, we're like, wow, everything's good. We finally got the answer. It's about to be cut out from underneath us. We know what's about to happen. We know about the sin with David and Bathsheba. And then we have Solomon. But we know that's going to be cut out from underneath us. Because Solomon is going to fall. And then the kingdom is going to be divided. And those two kingdoms are going to fall. So as we read this prophecy, remember there is a sense of question here. Okay. God's promised there's going to be a king. None of the kings we see seem to be the answer. Most of them are terrible, but even the really good kings, as we'll read about King Hezekiah and King Josiah, they're not the answer because they die and their kingdom is lost. So there is a tension that is now introduced to the biblical story of what's going on with this king who's going to build a house for the Lord that will stand forever. Because remember, that temple is also destroyed. So there's a tension that's being brought into the story. And I'm highlighting all of this because as we're reading through the Old Testament, there's all of these threads that are coming in. As we get to the end of the Old Testament, we're like, there's so much left hanging. What about the seed of man? What about the promises of Israel? What about the temple? What about the king? What about the prophet who's going to come? What is the answer to all of this? And it's like everything is tightening up and you're getting tenser, you're getting anxious, and then Jesus. That's how God brings all of these disparate threads together. Remember, we're viewing it from the perspective of 2,000 years later, where we know the end of the story. But imagine being an Israelite in these days, in the days of the divided kingdom, in the days of the exile, thinking, God, how are you going to do all of this? You've made all these promises, and we know you're faithful to your promises. We know that you hold true to your promises. But God, it's really confusing. We don't see how this is going to happen. And that narrative tension all comes to a fulfillment when we get to the New Testament. And so this promise of the king who's going to build a dynasty, of a king who's going to build a house for the Lord. That narrative tension, pay attention to that. Pay attention to that thread as we get into the, frankly, the failures of the following kings, but also the prophets who will say it's not over yet. There's more to come in this story. And so the first part of 2 Samuel, again, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, the first part of 2 Samuel, everything seems to go really, really well. David is victorious. He is finally king over the entirety of Israel. There's no more of these divided 12 tribes, of these 12 tribes fighting amongst each other and hating one another. They're all united once more under a single king. They have been granted rest from their enemies. They are fighting against all of these enemies, and they are victorious. They defeat the Amalekites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Philistines and all these people, and everything seems to be going so well. And in chapter 10, we see David's great victory, and then we're cut out from underneath this again. And chapter 11 occurs, and we're left wondering once more, how is God going to bring about success in the midst of such flawed people? We're going to talk about 2 Samuel in the latter half next week. But the wonderful, beautiful thing is that we do know the end of this story. We do know that David, while he does sin, he is a righteous man. He makes amends for his failures. But we know that he's not the final king. And David himself knew that he was not the final king, because David pointed forward in his Psalms so often to his descendant. In the midst of what's going to become a very dark period of time for David, as his kingdom begins to crumble around him, as his family turns to violence and destruction, David's hope remains firmly planted in the Lord. And that's one of the most important things we can take from the book of Samuel. As we read the contrast between Saul and David, both flawed men, both men who commit terrible errors, but one man puts his trust in himself. One man tries to win by his strength and his strength alone, and he falls. And one man, in the midst of his failure, will turn to the power of God. The same God that he trusted when things were going well, he will trust when things go poorly as well. And though everything around David starts to crumble, he has faith that God will not. And that's the type of faith that we need to have. We're about to partake of a memorial of that final son of David, of the king of Israel that had been prophesied all the way back. Think about that, 3,000 years ago. All the way back, God was working this plan. And when that king finally came, he came in a very different way than we would have expected. He came to serve, and he came to die. And he came to teach us how to be servants and people who are unafraid of death. If you find yourself today needing King Jesus in some way, if you find yourself in need of the great blessings that he has, if there's anything we can do to help, won't you let us know while we stand and while we sing?